People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio. This is Rodney Trudgeon introducing you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, recently, the UCT Summer School had a lecture which particularly interested me. It was called A Composer's Midlife Crisis, Wagner Before and After Schopenhauer. And the lecture attempted to reconcile two outwardly contradictory views of the 19th century composer, Richard Wagner. For example, where Thomas Mann argued for a basic unity underlying his perfectly consistent and fully rounded life's work, there is, on the other hand, a widespread conviction that Wagner was never the same after encountering the pessimistic philosophy of Arthur Schopenhauer while midway through his greatest work, The Ring. And this seeming paradox can nonetheless be resolved by seeing the composer shift in outlook as enabling the maturation and enrichment of his earlier aims. And having read that, I was completely gripped, and although I couldn't make it to the lectures, I thought the next best thing is to invite the lecturer into the studio. And I'm very glad he's agreed. His name is Dr. Jamie McGregor, who is a lecturer in literary studies in English at Grahamstown's University. Jamie, welcome.
Thanks, Rodney.
It's a tough subject, but we're going to make it fun, I think. But what I'd like to know, you're a lecturer in literary studies in English.
Yes.
So how does Wagner and philosophy come into it?
It's not an easy fit, as you can imagine. My first sort of official foray in my graduate research, for example, was via Wagner's literary influence. So it's quite a substantial field in its own right. A great number of modernist writers, T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland, James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, the great modernist writers, all clearly influenced by Wagner in many ways. Eliot in The Wasteland, for example, alludes to passages in both the Ring and in Tristan.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think people do actually underestimate just how much Wagner wrote. Mm. We know he was constantly writing. I think he even edited a newspaper at one stage and writing pamphlets. Mm. But there's a substantial amount of literature, isn't there, written by Wagner?
Oh, yes. Yes, he was endlessly prolific.
And what's it like? Is it? I haven't even read his autobiography. Is it penetrable?
It varies. I mean, well, first of all, I must be upfront about my limitations that come with a background in literary studies. I'm not a musician or musicologist, as I said, and I also don't read German, so I only know Wagner in translation.
Right.
But given that, his autobiography is pretty entertaining. Nietzsche and others have said, you know, it has to be taken with a large grain of salt. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's certainly hugely subjective and often very offensive to all sorts of people. But it's certainly an entertaining read. But his prose theory, opera and drama and so on, is notoriously impenetrable and turgid.
Yes.
And I've only, even in translation, only bothered with passages from it. It's much better to read other people on Wagner's theory than Wagner himself.
And there's a lot of that as well,
yes,
isn't there?
Yes.
There's some. Someone once said there's a huge amount of literature on Wagner, even more than religious characters.
That's right.
In some cases, but so not being a musician and not being, so it was reading Wagner's writings that drew you to his operas, was it?
It was the other way round, which I think is perhaps more natural. Of course, what makes Wagner great, of course, is the music.
Absolutely.
And
it was
through a love of music that I was drawn to explore his world, which then, of course, as you discover, is a great literary world as well.
I mean, it is extraordinary also. We use the word, I think, extraordinary a lot with Wagner, that he wrote all his own librettos. We think of Boito with Verdi and Da Ponte with Mozart, but there was Wagner tackling things like the Tristan poem, for example, or Nordic mythology, and writing his own prose.
Yes, yes, remarkable. And in fact, this is one of the things you pick up in the earlier parts of the biography, is he claims, and it seems to be sincere and genuine that he set out in his teens to be a literary writer first and foremost, and then decided to take up music because he wanted to start setting his dramas to music rather than the other way around. So it's as if he became a composer backwards almost.
And famously, he wanted to change the world, didn't he?
Yes.
The other thing that I think a lot of people don't realise is that Wagner is not a right-wing fanatic. He was a left-wing revolutionary.
Yes.
And quite a fierce one, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He participated in the 1848 and 49 uprising in Dresden. Yeah.
And then had to flee to Zurich, as we know. So
that's right.
This mad idea that he had that art should be, well, what, maybe it wasn't that mad, treated quite differently and be thrown onto its head and start again, gave him the sort of passion of his early works. And then, as we're going to talk about here, came this midlife crisis when he came across Schopenhauer. Mm-hmm. So for our first, before we get involved in Schopenhauer, for our first musical excerpt, now you've chosen part of the Overture to the Flying Dutchman, and this is Wagner in his young, youthful, very much under the influence of people like Hegel, I think, and those chaps, Feuerbach.
He'd certainly been dabbling in reading philosophy that early. Not sure that he'd even got to Feuerbach yet. There are funny stories about him trying to read Hegel and not making head or tail of it. But the interesting thing about The Flying Dutchman, of course, is that, as pretty much all commentators agree, this is the first sign we have of the authentic Wagner as a musical personality. It's the first really distinctive work
and with his incredible command of the orchestra. The sequence we're going to play from the overture is just after the redemption theme, where you hear the crashing waves and the howling gale. So hear a short excerpt from the overture to The Flying Dutchman by Wagner. We leave that dramatic music there. That's part of the overture to The Flying Dutchman by a very young Wagner, as we said, Wagner's first true Wagnerian opera. And that was played by the Berlin Philharmonic and Herbert von Karajan, and depicting there the tumultuous seas and also Wagner's skill with the orchestra, which he acquired quite early, quite clearly, didn't he? And my guest is Dr. Jamie McGregor, who's a lecturer in literary studies in English and recently delivered a lecture at UCT Summer School called A Composer's Midlife Crisis, Wagner Before and After Schopenhauer. What I find interesting, I read some in Brian McGee's rather magnificent book, Wagner Philosophy, which you know, don't you?
Yes, yes, it's a great influence on me.
I read it in Germany just before I went to see Tristan and Isolde, so it equipped me, shall we say. But he says there how interesting it is with Schopenhauer. There were six operas before and six operas afterwards. It really came right in the middle of, I think it was six, of Wagner's life.
Yes.
So when he was this young man and wandering around reading all these philosophers' works and wanting to change the universe, the theory is that most of his work at that time was very much based on his ideas. So when this change came about, it was a big life-changing moment, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, it really was.
Would you be able to tell me what it is about Schopenhauer that attracted Wagner? Or, I mean, this is an impossible question, Jamie. I can see you smiling already. The man in the street, what is Schopenhauer all about? He's regarded as a pessimistic philosopher.
I think the key to this is to emphasize the pessimism and emphasize how it fitted in with Wagner's personality even before he encountered Schopenhauer's work, which happened at the age of 41. So, yes, very much in the middle of his career. And I do have obviously greatly reduced and to some extent dumbed down version of what McGee writes about at much greater length and very eloquently. And anyone who really wants to understand the subject in depth should turn to McGee's work. But the short version is this, that Wagner from early in life, and one already hears this very clearly in The Flying Dutchman, was a great pessimist himself. He clearly felt that the world was a dreadful place in many ways, and that his own experience of life was one of endless frustration. And he wanted to do something about it, and see, this drive to change the world that you've already mentioned is a drive in the operas, that one can feel this tension in them. And of course, by the time he gets to The Ring, this is his big project. We have political allegory in The Ring. Much of the original work, not for the music, which came later, but for the libretto, the ideas in it, dates from the same period as his involvement in the Dresden Uprising, which we talked about. So the Ring clearly has this political program. How do we change the world? How do we move from a law-governed to a love-governed universe? His greatest philosophical influence at this point is Feuerbach and the new doctrine of love and a kind of socialist utopia.
Element of sexual freedom.
Oh, a great element of sexual freedom, which, of course, the music gives wonderful expression to as well.
Absolutely.
And then in the middle of composing The Ring, so he's written the whole libretto for all four parts at this stage, and he's composed Das Rheingold throughout, and the first act of Die Walküre. And at this point, he reads Schopenhauer for the first time. And Schopenhauer does three things, essentially, to Wagner. He confirms, yes, the world is absolutely a dreadful place. In Schopenhauer's estimation, it's the worst of all possible worlds. His great concept, of course, is the will. Everything is fundamentally will, and Wagner must have recognized this in himself. A point that McGee makes is that Wagner himself was will incarnate.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
One of the reasons why he experienced so much frustration, that he couldn't fulfill his ambitions quickly enough. And so Schopenhauer convinces him he's been right about that all along. But Schopenhauer is a greater pessimist than Wagner. In his view, there is no cure, certainly not a political one. If there's any redemption available, it's of a metaphysical nature, but it's not traditionally religious in a Western sense, at least. Schopenhauer himself later discovered, when he brought out the second edition of The World as Will and Representation, that his philosophy had a great deal in common with Eastern religions.
Buddhism, for example.
Yes, especially Buddhism. The idea of the the world is a kind of veil of illusions, mm-hmm. and something that needs to be ignored and repudiated and turned away from. And this, I think, was a real shock to Wagner, because the sort of quasi-political solution that The Ring is attempting to set up now becomes impossible in a Schopenhauerian sense, but something else becomes possible instead, which is this sort of retreat within and denial and renunciation and so on.
Yes, and that, as you say, happened in the middle of The Ring, and it must have been, from what I've read, and certainly McGee pointed out, that it created a huge crisis for him, because he was so convinced about what he was doing when he set out on The Ring. Now he's got to change his whole philosophical outlook. And he did fairly successfully, didn't he? And I know in the middle of The Ring there was a 25-year break. I think it was at the end of Act 2 of Siegfried. And when the music comes back, I've always thought for Act 3 of Siegfried, 25 years later,
I think it's 12 years.
Oh, 12 years. Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. But it's a remarkably long period of time. And you immediately hear a difference in the music is agitated, and it's a dramatic change from what's gone before.
It is, and yet he's using the same material, the same mass of leitmotifs.
That's right, the famous leitmotifs.
Run through the early operas continue. But, of course, within that gap, significantly, he's composed both Tristan and Isolde and Die Meistersinger. And, and from the experience of composing those two heavily Schopenhauer-influenced and very different works, he then comes back to The Ring with a much greater musical as well as philosophical experience, and that explains the shift.
And then this whole redemption through the love of a woman, which we'll come to. But our next piece of music, you've chosen something I think quite unexpected, the Forest Murmurs sequence from Act 2 of Siegfried, as a kind of illustration of the Schopenhauerian change. Tell me why you've chosen this and what's its significance.
Well, this is pretty much the point where Wagner breaks off The Ring before the long gap. So it's a period, another period of crisis in his life, when he's now read Schopenhauer a few times. He's absorbing the philosophy. He's becoming a convert, and he's torn between the kind of twin pressures of wanting to continue The Ring and then wanting to turn aside to this new project, Tristan. And so the second act of Siegfried is the last of the parts of The Ring that he writes before coming back to the third act 12 years later. And McGee believes, and I agree with him, that one can start to hear some of Schopenhauer's influence in the music at this point. Now, how to explain this? The point McGee makes very well is that Wagner decided that he didn't need to change the text of The Ring at all to accommodate his new agreement with Schopenhauer. But because he still had more of the music to compose, he could change the relationship of text to music. So what happens if one reads the libretto of Siegfried? At this point, it's very simple. He is resting in the forest. He's been led there by the dwarf Mimer, who wants him to kill the dragon Fafnir so that he can gain the ring of power for himself. And so Siegfried is the unwitting dupe of Mimer's plot at this point. And there he is alone outside the dragon's cave. He's the young, fearless hero. He seems not so much unperturbed by the presence of the dragon as forgetful of it at this stage. He's resting in the forest. And the action on paper is very simple. It is stage directions, the light increases, it's dawn filtering through the forest. But what the music does is more extraordinary. It doesn't simply depict this as a wonderful piece of romantic nature painting, though it is that as well. It gives us this sense of the hero in solitary communion with nature. And Schopenhauer is very eloquent about this, how in moments of stillness, moments of contemplation, one ceases to be simply an individual, but achieves this kind of almost Buddhistic oneness with the cosmos, and somehow, I don't know how, one senses this in the music, and this deep relaxation that emanates through it. And this is a powerful philosophical feeling rather than an idea.
Okay, thank you. That's very interesting. So let's listen now to an excerpt from the scene of Siegfried lying there enjoying nature. The forest murmurs. There you are, a moment of pastoral relaxation in the second act of Siegfried, the third of the Ring operas by Wagner, the sequence known as Forest Murmurs, with the Vienna Philharmonic there, conducted by Sir George Scholte from that famous set of the Ring. And my guest is Dr. Jamie McGregor, lecturer in literary studies in English. But Dr. Jamie has recently delivered a lecture at the UCT Summer School, A Composer's Midlife Crisis, Wagner Before and After Schopenhauer. And when I saw that, I couldn't resist inviting you into the studio, Jamie. So we've now discovered that Schopenhauer's got his grip, and they never met, did they? Wagner and Schopenhauer never met, which is strange.
He had a very narrow opportunity to meet him, and sort of balked at the last hurdle. He was, of course, still in exile. And Schopenhauer, of course, was a generation older. And Wagner's exile only came to an end a few months before Schopenhauer died. Of course, he didn't know he was going to die so soon. But he visited Germany briefly and Frankfurt, where Schopenhauer was staying. And McGee believes that Schopenhauer was perhaps the only person in Wagner's life that he felt sufficiently in awe of not to be equal to the encounter. And that's the reason that he didn't take the opportunity to visit him.
Quite a thing to say, isn't it? Because Wagner used to think he was just the greatest. And everyone was beneath him, whether they were philosophers or musicians, singers, conductors. And he, Schopenhauer, when Cosima, I think, in her diaries often referred to how much Schopenhauer was read in the house by both
of
them.
On a daily basis.
On a daily basis, yeah. And that Wagner was constantly reading these over and over again. It must have had, as we've said, a huge impact on him. And it went on, didn't it, when he stopped the Ring at the end of Act Two of Siegfried to write Tristan, which is, I think some people even call it the Schopenhauer opera.
Yes.
He had recently met and I think fallen in love with Matilda Wesendonck, although he was living with her and her husband. And I've often wondered, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, was Tristan a result of his passion for women and redemption by women, or was it Schopenhauer's, was it just the perfect moment for his Schopenhauer ideas to come out with this love of Matilda? It's a congealed question. I don't know if you can make anything of that.
That's a really good question, Rodney. The role of erotic love in Wagner's life, of course, is hugely significant and not to be discounted. But I think it is ultimately philosophy that takes precedence here. And again, one has to refer to McGee's work because it is simply so authoritative, and almost the great original discovery that he makes in his work is knowing Schopenhauer as well as he does. He is able to decode a letter that Wagner wrote to Liszt about his first conception for Tristan, which has been quite mysterious until McGee comes along, because he describes the first idea for the opera as being a simple but full-blooded musical conception. McGee asked the question, what on earth do you mean by this? And his answer is a very convincing one, that Schopenhauer talks a great deal about music in his work, far more than is common for philosophers to do. And to cut a long story short, he describes music as a unique art because it is non-representative, but it is rather the voice of the metaphysical will itself. It describes our inner emotional life, which is the will.
And which words can't really.
This is right. And then very, very technically, he gives examples of types of music and talks about harmonic suspension and how this creates tension in the listener. And McGee believes that this gives Wagner the idea for a musical work in which harmonic suspension will be sustained to the most unbearable point for a full-length opera and only resolved at the end. And that is, in fact, the very technical explanation for this work.
But Tristan is so famous for those suspensions and unresolved chords, and the famous Tristan chord, which opens the opera, which is not really resolved at all. Some people say not even at the end. But nonetheless, I mean, one of the extraordinary things about sitting through Tristan for 5 hours is this ceaseless kind of yearning and nothing ever being resolved. And it's tremendously powerful as a result. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that Schopenhauer knew that much about music?
Yes, he was an extremely knowledgeable man on a wide variety of topics, music included. And he even includes very simple, but nonetheless includes musical examples in The World as Will.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know. Do you think, I don't know the answer to this question, do you think Schopenhauer knew about Wagner and Wagner's fascination with him?
It's a difficult question. He knew very little of Wagner because, of course, the influence goes very much one way. Schopenhauer is very much at the end of his life and career by the time Wagner discovers him. He did know of him. He had seen some of the early operas, Flying Dutchman, for example, which unconsciously foreshadows a kind of Schopenhauerian pessimism. He didn't seem to have much opinion of him as a composer, but he admired his librettos, I think. And Wagner sent him a copy of the Ring libretto, which Schopenhauer read and annotated, but never replied to. He seems to have been offended that Wagner sent it with a kind of a note in the margin, I think, but no covering letter.
Yes, I read that. So McGee's talks that story. Do you know what other philosophers thought of Schopenhauer or what he thought of them? I mean, his change was so dramatic, it must also have affected the likes of Hegel and Feuerbach, or possibly they had died before then. Nietzsche, for example.
Schopenhauer is a huge influence on Nietzsche and later on Wittgenstein. He himself is very much a maverick, and this is, many people think, partly the explanation why he's so attractive to non-philosophers and creative artists. He's very much swimming against the current, and he himself despises most of his immediate forerunners, particularly Hegel, and writes very rude and very funny things about what charlatans he thinks they all are.
You gave a lovely quote before we came into the studio. Was it Schopenhauer talking about Hegel?
Yes, he called him a lasting monument to German stupidity.
One has to laugh. Yeah. I'm sure that would have amused Wagner at the end, but not at the beginning. Mm. We've been talking about Tristan, the great Schopenhauer opera, shall we call it. Mm. And we're going to play something from Tristan now, and we're trying to decide what. And we've decided on that extraordinary moment in Act Two, in the middle of the love duet, where who knows what those two are meant to be doing, Tristan and Isolde in the dark, and Brangäne, who's Isolde's handmaiden, is keeping watch. And she sings a warning from a tower. And that's what we're going to play, Jamie. Do you agree? And this is...
Yes.
Do listen to the extraordinary orchestration here and to the atmosphere that Wagner creates. Isn't that so? The solo violin, the
absolutely
the sort of
sublime
shimmering orchestra. Mm-hmm. Isn't it the most magical moment in opera? That scene where Brangäne is singing a warning to the lovers, Tristan and Isolde, warning them about approaching danger. And just listening to that orchestration, and incidentally, that was the famous recording with Wilhelm Furtwängler, his famous Philharmonia London recording, and bringing out that texture so magnificently. Mm. And Jamie, it just proves what a magic effect both Matilda and Schopenhauer had on Wagner to produce this remarkable mm-hmm. opera, Tristan and Isolde.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting irony, of course, in that Schopenhauer himself has, being such a pessimist, a very dim view of erotic love as well. He sees this as a further manifestation of the will at its most destructive. And Wagner clearly agrees to an extent in portraying this great tale of passionate, destructive love. But he also infuses it with Schopenhauerian ideas, that this kind of death wish that the lovers experience is a desire to escape from this world into a kind of transcendental nothingness in which they will be truly as one.
That is the whole thrust, isn't it, of Tristan, that a death wish. It was impossible to be in love to the extent they were in this particular world.
That's right. It's a desire so great that it can never be satisfied by anything except total annihilation.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I think the Liebestod at the end is so impressive, because of the words that Isolde sings, implying that this was now moving out of this world and into a transcendental world, as you said.
And the erotic now becoming religious in a way.
Oh, there you go, because I was interested. I mean, Wagner, I would have thought, would be annoyed with Schopenhauer, because Wagner was so... Eroticism seemed to have meant a lot to him, because he did womanize quite a lot. So it's interesting that he accepted that about Schopenhauer.
It is interesting, and he continues to live an adventurous erotic life until his last decade, when he's working on Parsifal.
But this is the thing. So we had Tristan and Isolde. This is all the break in the ring, and then Meistersinger, which is really his comedy, the great comedy about the German culture and all that. And those are two very different operas. But do you believe that Schopenhauer is present in Meistersinger?
Very much so. But in disguise, in a way. Unlike Tristan, which is wholly Schopenhauerian in conception, Wagner's first idea for an opera on the Meistersinger subject goes back to his earlier days when he's still working on Tannhäuser. And he shelves that project for a long time and only comes back to it after Tristan. And at this stage, he embellishes his original story, keeping the comic surface and the strong autobiographical element, which is interesting. The story is very much an ironic summing up of his own career and his struggle with the musical and critical establishment.
You know, we mentioned Parsifal, and of course he then finished Meistersinger, and he eventually finished The Ring. And then along came Parsifal, this curiously sort of, I want to say pseudo-religious, but is that being a bit cynical?
No, I think that's fair, because like Schopenhauer, Wagner was not a conventionally religious man at all.
And, yet he wanted to write an opera on Jesus.
Which in a sense is perhaps what Parsifal
is. Well, yes, true. And once again we have a naive hero, what was the phrase he uses? The wise fool, or something like that.
Yes, the pure fool.
Yes. And this opera is infused, isn't it, with an intensely spiritual world, whether it's Christian or not, although it has to do with the cup of the Last Supper. But here also this opera breathes Schopenhauer, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. It uses Christian symbolism largely because of the subject matter, the medieval legends of the Grail. But through this, the central themes are really concerned, again, with the renunciation of this world, a renunciation of desire, the importance of compassion. Mitleid, the German word, and Schopenhauer's ethics very much based on a concept of compassion, of recognizing another's suffering in order to heal it, and the opera very much dramatizes this through the pure hero's encounter with the suffering Amfortas, the Grail King, who is, interestingly, as Wagner himself said, a kind of version of Tristan as well. The same heroes keep cropping up in different guises in different operas.
Mm-hmm.
As Parsifal is almost a reincarnation of Siegfried, and those two central operas are almost worked into this new one at the end of Wagner's career.
Well, now we're going to hear just a little excerpt from Parsifal. It's quite a challenge, isn't it, Jamie, to get short excerpts from Wagner?
Very much so.
This is
leading chunks.
Yes, indeed. This is just a sort of excerpt from Act One, where Gurnemanz, the wise monk, is talking about the background of the Grail.
Titurel, der fromme Held, ihr kannt ihn wohl. Wenn ihm da wilder Feinde List und Macht des reinen Glaubens reich bedrohten. Ihm neigten sich in heiligerster Nacht, der einst des Heilands
There you get a sense of some of those themes and that shimmering music that Wagner used in Parsifal, giving it an aura of spirituality there. Gurnemanz there talking about the background of of the opera, really, and that was sung by Kurt Moll with the Metropolitan Orchestra conducted by James Levine. We're running out of time, Dr. Jamie McGregor, who's lecturer in literary studies and English, talking about a composer's midlife crisis, Wagner before and after Schopenhauer. And I think you've given us a lot of food for thought about Schopenhauer and certainly the effect it had on Wagner. This obsession Wagner had with women and redemption through a woman like Isolde, like famously Brunhilde, unlike anything in Parsifal. Is that Schopenhauer-ish by any chance?
It is and it isn't, as we already saw as the case in Tristan, that Wagner identifies the love of woman before Freud, interestingly, with a kind of death instinct. And he manages to graft this into a Schopenhauerian view of the world because it is in death that one is liberated from the illusory world. And again, Wagner shifts the meaning of the ring, for example, not through politics as he originally intended, but through a more metaphysical conception, and this is articulated in the music far more than the words. So that the sacrifice of Brunhilde at the end of the ring, he does here change the wording somewhat from his original text, but it is in the scoring that one feels this sense of a release through a woman's sacrifice from the very much male-dominated world of politics that we've seen in the earlier operas, the obsession with the ring itself as the symbol of power, and the shift to a new socialist utopia as in the original Feuerbachian conception, but in a Tristan-like escape from the world altogether.
Mm-hmm. And through the sacrifice of Brunhilde.
Yes.
One of these great characters, isn't she, really? So powerful.
Really tremendous.
We have to stop. But just if anyone is keen to find out more, this book that we've been talking about by Brian McGee, I think you can find it on Amazon or wherever, and it's called Wagner and Philosophy. And you would say, wouldn't you, Jamie, that it's very well worth reading
if
you
really
want to see more.
Yes.
And it enhances your love of Wagner's music as well.
Very much so. McGee is a wonderful authority. Now, sadly, the late Brian McGee, after a long and distinguished career as a popularizer of philosophy and philosophers, and a great authority on Schopenhauer and his relationship with the composer, I would endorse it very warmly.
Well, we hope that we've whet your appetite, not only for Wagner, but also for Wagner's interest in philosophy and the effect Schopenhauer had on him. And we're going to end with a closing of Götterdämmerung, the Mighty Ring Cycle, where the redemption theme, which you've only heard once before in Act 2 of Valkyrie, comes back on the orchestra. And almost like a benediction, isn't it, brings this work to a close on a beautiful key, a beautiful chord. I was talking to Dr. Jamie McGregor, lecturer in literary studies in English, and we've been talking about a composer's midlife crisis, Wagner before and after Schopenhauer. And as we listen to the end of Götterdämmerung, Jamie, thank you very much for your time. And
thanks
for
having
so
me, Rodney. It's been a great pleasure.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Something magical is coming your way this festive season. Captain Hook's dropping anchor and Tinkerbell is flying in specially. The Lost Boys will be found and Wendy's in the house. Be awestruck by the most dazzling skating ever seen as Peter Turin presents the world-famous Imperial Ice Stars in this spectacular and new show, Peter Pan on Ice. Experience this much-loved family classic at the Artscape Opera House from January 15th to February 2nd, 2020. Book now.